Hello and welcome to the Talking Law and Guidance podcast with me, Sally Penny, MBE. This podcast is about important and significant cases. And this week is no different because we're going to discuss the Shamima Begum case. And I've got the perfect person who appeared in that case for it to discuss the topics and really what that judgment was about. Felicity Gerry, Queen's Counsel. Hello, Felicity.
Hi, Sally. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming to talk about the case. Now, Shamima Begum, I don't want to make it all entirely legal, but Shamima Begum was a young woman, as I understand it, who left the UK and got married and was pregnant with, went to the Middle East and is being classed as a terrorist, effectively, because she was part of a terrorist group. And I think she left with two women. And we'll come to details in a moment. But recently, there was a case last week, decision in her case. The Supreme Court had to decide whether or not she should be allowed to return to the UK to face a trial. Now, there are numerous cases in this case, aren't there? She's stateless, but she had some partial passport was withdrawn from her. I think her parents were from Bangalore. I'm trying not to sort of go and read the judgment per se. But I want to ask you from the beginning, really, what was your involvement? Because you were acting for justice.
Yes. It's really important to say I wasn't acting for her or for the parties, but there were three interveners in that case, one of whom were the organisation Justice. And I was briefed together with an Australian junior called Eamon Kelly to act on behalf of Justice to make some submissions to try and assist the court in relation to the law. So it's an unusual process whereby you can intervene in someone else's case. You have to have permission to intervene. And the idea is that you assist the court with relevant law. So that's how I came to be involved, partly because I'd researched the relevant law and also because I'd had some involvement in a similar matter in Australia with the junior who I led in the intervention. So it was one of those special procedures that allows us to try and help on how the law works in these extreme situations.
Yeah, so I suppose for sort of the budding lawyers among us who maybe are not working at that sort of higher level, if you like, it's a bit like the coroner's court, where the coroner, you are instructed as counsel to the coroner, as counsel to the coroner's court, and sometimes to deal with a specific legal issue. Like, you know, for example, I've appeared to deal with self-defense to assist the coroner's court if it's raised in a death or something, you know, a specific area. Is it a bit like that? I just want people to be
sort of, yes. I mean, there are two ways that I've intervened in other people's cases. One is as amicus curiae brief, and that's more traditionally where the court asks you to help on a particular issue. Yeah. So you can appear as amicus. And in those cases where I've done that specifically, I've led an intervention rather more as an expert in that field of law. So I had an amicus curiae brief in the ICTY and in some death penalty cases where I say, look, I know all about this, so I can help you. And usually I do that with academics who research in that area. So what we do is provide, I suppose, information of assistance to the court. Whereas an intervener is someone who says, well, hang on a minute, our organisation is the specialist in this particular area. We know what we're talking about and you need us to be there. And so it's a very slightly different process. But what we had in this case was a real rule of law issues. So Justice has a particular specialism on how does the rule of law work. And that's why we were instructed to intervene, because we raised some constitutional issues that were not necessarily being raised by the parties, but had been referred to it by the Court of Appeal or potentially referred to by the Court of Appeal. So because that's Justice's field of expertise, what they do then is instruct counsel to present the rule of law arguments to the court, or at least to ask for permission, which we were given, to make submissions to the court. And there were other interveners on the human rights issues and the human trafficking issues, which we also touched on. So the special rapporteur, people with serious expertise were represented to try and give the full framework to the court to help the court make a decision.
Yes. Now, this case evokes a lot of emotion, doesn't it? Because people feel as though her decision to leave the UK was taken when she was under 18, making her a child. And so she couldn't possibly have made that decision knowing all the facts or knowing that ISIS, the terrorist group, what they were or what would happen. And she's lost all her children. And others feel as though she made a decision and she must not be allowed to come back into the country. But I'd like to talk, please, about the law governing women or people who are effectively stateless, because there is some history, isn't there? On a basic human rights level, should people be allowed to return to their countries of origin to face whatever the misdemeanors there are? Or is the state right in saying, well, you made that decision, stay where you are? Because in this case, it was actually looking at the Secretary of State, I think it was at the time, wasn't it? I'm trying to remind myself of the judgment. I think it was it Savid Javid, the Home Secretary,
who made I think I can probably help in this way, that she was a British national at 15 years old with two other girls, travels overseas to apparently join ISIS, become what is labelled an ISIS bride, spend some time there, whether or not she committed any what we might call foreigner fighter offences. She did lose three children, one very publicly when she was speaking to journalists. It was known that the child was alive and then died. And she is in a camp in Syria and wants to come home to her mum and dad and her family. And what the Secretary of State did was strip her of citizenship. There were then effectively cross appeals. I won't go into too many technicalities,
yes,
but in relation to the deprivation of her citizenship and whether or not she should have leave to enter the UK in order to challenge that deprivation of citizenship. But the area of law that we particularly dealt with was some very, very ancient common law of allegiance, which is just a fascinating area of history. And you can read our submissions on the Justice website, so they're publicly available. And we did some research going back centuries. And the easiest way I can explain it really is to say, this is all really about who is a subject of a nation. So who is a British subject and how do you define who is a British subject? So aside from citizenship, which is a paperwork exercise, who actually belongs to Britain? It's very much about what is a nation state. It's made up of its territory and its people. So who is British? Who belongs? And the Australian law is actually rather more developed than it is, weirdly, in England and Wales, in the sense that, yeah, they've had some cases over the years where they've used this language of belonging, which I rather like. So we would say, who is a British subject or a British national? Not who is a citizen, but who belongs to, who is a subject of Britain? So we tend to use the language of subjecthood. But in Australia, they've started using the language of belonging, particularly in a case called Love and the Commonwealth that was decided in 2020. And what they had to assess was whether an Aboriginal person who was overseas had a right to return because he belonged to Australia. And of course, there's millennia of Aboriginal history that has nothing to do with paperwork as a result of the Australian administration. So there was a very controversial decision to allow him to return, if you like.
Yes.
And it's not about allowing people. It's who has a reciprocal right to be here. And the way in which the law on allegiance worked and has worked for thousands of years is to consider not just who owes allegiance to the state, but who should be protected by the state. So there's a sort of reciprocal rights and duties that existed long before the Human Rights Act, long before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But actually, we trace the history back as far as sort of barons and serfs. One of the authorities that we had was so old it was written in Latin, and we had to provide a translation. So it's about the language of allegiance, of course, is my liege, the person to whom you owe your allegiance is your liege. So this very ancient history about who do you owe your allegiance to, and therefore, if you owe your allegiance to that state, what duties does that state have to you?
Protect you, yeah.
And that's trying to put it as simply as possible. It can get a lot more complicated. And really what we were saying is, look, first of all, you've got to identify whether someone is still retains their subjecthood. Do they still have that allegiance? Now, people would say, well, no, she didn't, because she got on a plane when she was 15. And our argument would be, well, it'd be a really, really, really high bar to say that you remove subjecthood from a child. Then other people would say, well, she's not a child now and she's made her bed and she should lie in it. But we have a situation where you've got subjects of the British nation who are currently living in tents in a foreign country. Where do you draw the line? Do you say, well, look, if you've got a sex offender who travels to Thailand, what you really want to do is bring them back and put them on trial here. And we do have laws that allow for that to happen. We're very familiar with people being brought back and put on trial. So what's the difference between them and her? Why not bring her back and put her on trial if she's committed offences? So that the protection is not just about the protection of the individual, it's about the protection of the rule of law. So you're entitled to say, I can come home, and it may well be that the protection I have is to be prosecuted for a criminal offence because my state is responsible for me. And if I go abroad and carry out an offence, then my state should prosecute me and I should be brought back. So it might be protection in the ordinary sense of the word, but actually what it really is about is the protection of the rule of law. And these are judicial decisions.
Yes.
And at the moment, no one has made that decision about her. There's been no process. And it's exactly the same for anybody who is stateless. A stateless person is just somebody without paperwork. And at the moment, there's no real process to say, well, where do those people belong? And to me, that's a no-brainer. Every state should say, all right, well, we'll have a process. We'll have mutual recognition. We'll have evidence. We'll decide where people belong. Yeah. Some people might not like where it's decided they belong, but we have a transparent process that is a legal process, not a political process, that decides, as I say, where people belong. And that's never happened in her case. She's just had her citizenship removed. So in principle, she's got a constitutional right to return as a subject who has not had her allegiance, not given it up, not had it removed. She has constitutional right to return and have and engage in whatever process then takes place. And unfortunately, the court didn't decide those issues.
But
I think it's really interesting because what they did say was that they've given it careful consideration.
Yes, I can read that from the judgment. And what does that actually then mean? Because I'm
I think it means quite a lot.
Yeah.
You see, when the hearing took place, we were only allowed to make written submissions, which is quite common for interveners, but we were asked to attend, and obviously it all takes place online. And the arguments by the parties related to the exercise of the decision-making of the Secretary of State. The arguments for some of the interveners were, hang on a minute, you've got the human rights of a young woman here who's lost her children, who is potentially a trafficked person or a coerced child. We've made no findings about that. Our duties towards our citizens have got to be to make sure that their human rights are protected. So there were some really fantastic arguments around individual human rights.
Yes.
But the parties were arguing these policy decisions, the human rights basis of a policy decision as against national security. Now, our argument was this constitutional framework that you can't really get to citizenship and or citizenship stripping or statelessness unless and until you've decided that that person doesn't belong to your nation state, trying to put it as simply as possible. And the fact that it's not just that their lordship said that we've given this careful consideration. In the hearing itself, virtually every question, I can't say every question, but virtually every question was about this issue. And Lord Hodge in particular, who I asked quite a few questions, and I believe is the Scottish representative, must have been very familiar with Calvin's case that was decided in 1600 and something, which is in this thread of authority that we trace through thousands of years, where there was a decision about whether or not someone's Scottish or English. So there's I suspect he's very familiar with that. So we were quite fortified when the hearing was going on. We could see that their lordships were asking questions that related to the submissions that we had made. So we were quite excited, as you can imagine, to hear those questions, and frustrated that we couldn't answer them orally because we were only given permission to intervene in written submissions. But we then provided supplementary submissions, which you can also see on the Justice website, in which we tried to answer their lordship's questions, which included, for example, if the state does owe a duty to a national who is elsewhere, what duty do they have to facilitate that person's return? So do they have to go and fetch her? And there is a case in Australia that some people may remember called David Hicks, and he was in Guantanamo Bay, and he issued a writ of habeas corpus to say, well, actually, I'm being detained. My own country has got something to do with this detention of me. I'm not entirely sure exactly what it is, but I'm being detained. So I want a writ of habeas corpus in the sense of I want my nation to request my return. And the state in the federal court in Australia said, well, we want summary judgment. There's no law on this. And the judge said, well, hang on a minute. There's no modern authority, but there is a bit of law. I don't think I'm going to give you summary judgment. This really ought to go to trial so we can understand what the reciprocal rights and duties are.
Yes.
And before that went to trial, David Hicks was brought back. So it was never tested. So there is an authority to say, well, there might be something to argue here. We also have their lordships in the UK Supreme Court saying, well, we've given this careful consideration. This is interesting. Not what the parties are arguing, but it's interesting. And we've got the Australian High Court saying, well, look, we're moving very carefully and slowly and trying to look at what are the criteria for belonging. It's not just that you're born here. It's not just that your family are here. It must have something more to do with what is your connection to your nation state. So in a sense, whilst obviously I find it shocking that we have a world where we leave people sitting in camps instead of dividing up the groups and having systems to make sure that we know where everybody belongs and we don't have anybody living in camps. And from a humanitarian perspective, I find that personally appalling. In terms of what the law is, what we have here is senior courts in at least two jurisdictions really thinking about what does it mean to be a subject of a nation state and what duties do we owe to protect our subjects? And that it, in the sense of protecting them by giving them the protection of law, not just procedural fairness, but what, but the protection of the rule of law, which might also include prosecuting them. So it's a really fascinating area. And I think watch this space was my view on the decision of the UK Supreme Court. They certainly weren't saying no about anything that we'd argued.
Well, I wonder then, let's talk about kind of next steps and what might be available. Because ordinarily one would be going to the European Court of Human Rights or the ECJ, wouldn't you, from here. What other steps might you have? Or, reading in between the lines, could she bring another writ and argue perhaps the points that weren't argued in
between? I think what's really interesting is clearly there were some serious national security issues and we don't know what they are. And I'm certainly not privy to any sensitive material. And what's worth remembering is that their lordship said that whilst it wasn't a perfect solution, that there would be a stay. So they haven't said she can't come back. They haven't said she can't take part. What they've really said is, well, hang on until it's safe for her to do so. Not just safe for her, but safe for everybody, or as safe as it possibly can be, or how we can manage it to be safe. But let's say there's someone else in the camp that doesn't quite have her profile. My view is that these issues could well be tested on a writ for habeas corpus. I can't say what the parties are doing about other issues, appealing or taking it to the European Court of Human Rights in that sense, or going to the UN Human Rights Committee in that sense. But there is this history in England and Wales that I think does need to be tested in the same way as it's being tested in Australia. And there is an example, which is the case of Joyce, which is really quite famous and some of your listeners might have read about just as a matter of historical interest. But during the Second World War, there was a Nazi propagandist who broadcast under the name Lord Haw-Haw. He was known as Lord Haw-Haw, the humbug of Hamburg. And yes, he spoke in a terribly smart accent and broadcast dreadful Nazi propaganda. It was just horrendous, really. But weirdly became very popular, sort of a figure of fun. And he was such a hoot that people, it may say something about the British public, of course, but that it became popular. And whatever the government tried to do, people would listen in to Lord Haw-Haw as a bit of a joke.
Yeah. Well, I'm not laughing. I've heard it. I have tried to in prep for this, but just because of the name, his name.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's easy to find. It's fascinating stuff, really. And then after the Second World War, I wouldn't want to listen to anything that he said, of course. Horrendous that he was broadcasting Nazi propaganda. But after the Second World War, they found him, I think in Berlin, and brought him back and put him on trial for treason, which it seems to me is, at least morally, the right thing to do. We're responsible for our subjects. We go and find them. We bring them back and we put them on trial. And on a very simple basis, frankly, that appears to be what we should be doing with people who have engaged in terror. And it does worry me that that's probably what we would do if it was a man. But because it's a woman, she's left to wander about in a camp. So I do think we have a responsibility to put people on trial whom we consider to have committed the most heinous of offences, or not, if they haven't, if there's no evidence of them doing so. That's what we mean by the rule of law. And he was brought back, put on trial at the Bailey, and tried for treason. Now, in the court of public opinion, there was real concern, because back then the death penalty was available and he was indeed hanged. Yeah. But a lot of members of the public said, well, should we really be hanging a broadcaster rather than the people who actually committed the war crime? So he also had some semblance of public support, even though he had supported the appalling Nazi atrocities through the propaganda that he was promoting. So people were really concerned about hanging someone who was a broadcaster rather than an active combatant.
Yes.
But his defence really was, well, I'm not a subject. I'm not a British subject, so you can't try me for treason. And he was, in fact, probably either Irish or American, but somewhere in a drawer when they picked him up, he'd got this out-of-date, defunct passport. Some people say it was a forgery. I haven't really looked into all the evidence, but there was this out-of-date passport in a drawer and a question of law as to whether or not he still owed allegiance to the UK. And it was decided to put him on trial for what he'd done during the dates of that passport, out-of-date passport, and not anything else. And so therefore he was deemed to still owe allegiance as a matter of law on something as thin as possession of an out-of-date passport, where it was recognised he wasn't born here and he didn't have any of those other criteria that have not been very well identified that make you a subject. So he was deemed to have allegiance at a very low level that was strong enough to hang him.
Wow.
So one would think that some of these women and children in Syrian camps who are ostensibly citizens,
yes,
and probably definitely subjects who haven't had their allegiance given up or removed, will have more connection, belong more to the UK, to Great Britain, whichever nation we're considering, I would say the United Kingdom, if probably have more connection to the United Kingdom than he did. In which case, you can start to see how that framework works, that it is a constitutional protection that is the separation of powers, that so that the protection of law, whether it's protection in terms of going to fetch you and bring you home, or the protection of going to fetch you, bring you home and put you on trial, comes from the separation of powers, that these protections of law come when there's an excess of political power. And what we have here is politics saying, well, you can't come home. A judicial process will say, well, actually, there's a right to, because they owe allegiance to the nation state. And we've had the concept of a nation state, at least since the treaties of Westphalia, but we've had this concept of subjecthood for hundreds of years before that, going back to when we wrote law in Latin. So I think it's a really interesting space to watch. Plainly, the Australian High Court is grappling with these issues of belonging. I love the language of belonging. I think you should have a system whereby you decide allegiance before you ever decide whether or not someone can have their citizenship stripped. I think that would work in statelessness. The American expression would probably be due process. I think it's a way of emptying out these appalling camps where people are living. And it's beyond a moral duty to go and fetch people and bring them home, which some countries have done. Some countries have gone and collected their own citizens, but it's a way of keeping us all safe, actually, that we don't have these hotbeds in camps of where things can go horribly wrong again. So, look, it's not every argument. There are humanitarian law arguments. There's arguments around terrorism as a separate area of law, so you don't get the protections that you would if you were a combatant in an officially recognised war.
Yes.
Arguments about whether these are criminal offences at all. There's the commitments to protecting trafficked women, coerced children, and treating women without discrimination that might mean actually you've got to put people on trial. There's a whole load of other laws that we have to think about in this context that is beyond the name of Shamima Begum and matters to all of us.
Yes.
We wouldn't want to leave home and then not be allowed back in. And that's very real to many, many people who are subjects of nations during COVID-19 who can't get home.
Yes.
So
yes,
it should matter to all of us. I think it's an area of law that is very little understood, that their lordships were asking some really great questions about, that they haven't dismissed out of hand. She's on a stay. Shamima Begum hasn't had her case completely dismissed. It's a form of waiting to see. And again, I think that I'm delighted we had the opportunity to make that intervention for justice. I'm delighted that we have an organisation as robust and solid that has as its priority the rule of law issues that affect us all. And I think it is something that is developing around the world. If we are committed to a system of nation states rather than globalization, and that's a massive political debate, of course, then nation states have to take responsibility for what their citizens and their subjects do. So, look, I'm very grateful to be able to talk to you about it and to explain it in a very simple way, I must say. Yeah. But I hope it helps people to think about what they would expect their nation to do in relation to everybody, not just the one particular person we've seen in this particular case.
Yes, and you're spot on with the explanation. I wanted to ask you, though, about public policy. Look, you and I, you know, you've been a barrister for longer than me. I've been a barrister 21 years, and we've seen in a lot of decisions, sometimes it feels like there's a public policy decision behind the actual rule of law. And I'm looking at the statute which governs, it's an immigration law really specifically governs how people become stateless. And it's section 40 of the British Nationality Act, which was amended, has been amended heavily over the years. But the right of a citizenship of a person is entirely at the satisfaction of the Home Secretary, isn't it? And so once the Home Secretary is satisfied that you should lose your citizenship, then the citizenship is lost by instant operation of the law. But I'm really just interested, really, how then? Because I wondered, you know, people have called this decision an illiberal decision by the UK Supreme Court. And I just wonder if there's a public policy there. Here we are with, you know, very difficult and appalling atrocities being committed by groups calling themselves all sorts. And I just wonder if an example is required to be set, that if you make those decisions, and the Secretary of State makes a decision to revoke, withstanding everything we talked about, but to revoke your citizenship, then we need to set clear examples as a deterrent. And there has to be public policy. And do you think there was a bit of that in there? Because that's how I've read.
Yeah, look, I think the way I think about it is this. I think, and I alluded to it a little bit earlier on, that since 9/11, we have created this sort of separate area of law that is terrorism law.
Yeah.
And It's largely because the UN decided that we were going to have a criminal justice response. We were going to say that Al-Qaeda were criminals, that we weren't going to have declare war against a state that we didn't recognise. Now, if you do have a war, we have international humanitarian law, we have rules of engagement, we have the Geneva Conventions. There's a whole heap of law that comes with a war of how we treat foreign fighters, prisoners of war, and so forth, without me going into all of that. Then because the decision by the United Nations was to say we're going to have a criminal justice response, what that for us as lawyers would mean, well, you're treated as a criminal and therefore you have these protections that come with criminal trials or procedural fairness. And over time, since 9/11, we've seen all these new pieces of legislation that have been specific to terrorism that have become very much public law procedures, which involve issues of policy. And one of those is citizenship stripping, taking away people's paperwork and some of their identity. I would say not their subjecthood. That's separate and not been dealt with. And the wonderful thing about having a Human Rights Act is that it does create normative effect normally on policy. So governments have to make decisions that apply the commitments to human rights principles. So you get a whole body of law, public law, where you're considering whether or not people in making decisions in government are making it in accordance to what we've committed to. So the Human Rights Act creates that normative effect that governments are supposed to make better decisions. But we then have a process whereby we can challenge those decisions. And the biggest test for that is the danger to everyone that might come about if a person is brought back to the United Kingdom and there is a reaction to her return that makes us all unsafe, or if that person is left without their citizenship in a camp with some form of appeal process. So within government, with that type of legislation, it allows government to make those national security, individual liberty decisions. And what the UK Supreme Court said was, you've got to give respect to government to make those decisions. And what they're really saying when they use that language is, there is a separation of powers. There, within this context, where there's a statute, yes, where there's a policy and you've got to balance national security with individual human rights, that's what government's about. That's not what courts are about. We're here to deal with when that goes wrong.
Yes.
And here we have a situation where one party is saying it's gone wrong, the other party is saying it's gone right, and it's currently unresolvable. So we've got to give respect to government for those policy, that policy decision making. So it is conservative, small c, but it's understandable because it's a how policy is decided, which is a government decision. If we're going to maintain the separation of powers, what the UK Supreme Court was saying, we're the judicial body and we can deal with challenges to decision making unless and until the decision maker is dealing with something as complex as national security. But had the court engaged in, and I thought they could, because the Court of Appeal had effectively exercised a prerogative power by saying she's got a right to re-enter.
Yes.
I thought the UK Supreme Court could engage in these issues now in her case and say, well, hang on a minute, let's have a think about her allegiance. What's the process? Well, we're going to remit it for a process. Maybe they could have made a decision that actually you can't strip someone of their citizenship unless you've decided their allegiance first. Those were all the things that I thought they could do, but really just relying on the fact that the Court of Appeal appeared to have exercised or engaged in a prerogative power rather than a policy decision. And on the policy decisions, the UK Supreme Court said that in many ways, they said, I think, four ways in which the Court of Appeal were wrong. And they didn't go on to decide how the prerogative power works. So I think it's a long way of answering your question that policy is generally a matter for government.
Yes.
And what we have here is a challenge that has not yet been resolved because, of course, the solution, which was described as not perfect, is a stay, which means at the moment nothing can be done, which is really terrible solution for everybody in the sense we don't have an answer. And I come back to, I just think it's our duty and responsibility to create answers, to, and that is by way of due process, and particularly for women and girls. Women and girls, where there's ample research of exploitation, of trafficking, of coercion, and lack of autonomy, where you shouldn't be assuming someone is autonomous and has agency simply because they got married and have children. You should have a due process that decides whether someone's a foreign fighter or an exploited person. So I just take the view, having looked at all this research with these, you know, 1,000 years of law, that that's what it's really about. It's about saying we take responsibility for our nation. And in that sense, the policy arguments would fall away. And it's a understanding of what the nation state really means and who belongs. So I come round to that every time, because that was the area of law that I was so interested in. I think it absolutely applies in Australia. I think Australia could put its foot on the pedal about bringing their own citizens home, which they're not doing. And I haven't researched every other Commonwealth country, but I think because it's based in common law principles that do not appear to have been excluded in any Commonwealth country, as far as I can tell, every Commonwealth country, frankly, in my opinion, should go and fetch their own and create a process and manage that process. I'm not necessarily going to think through the details about how that's achieved, but every country has sent planes all around the world to fetch their citizens home in a pandemic. So it's perfectly practically achievable.
Yes. Well, and a desire to want to do it. Interestingly, it's interesting thinking about constitutional law and, you know, in 2021, isn't it really? In this sense that, and, you know, habeas corpus issuing writs, and very old cases like, you know, Liveridge and Anderson, which is a really quite an old case, a 1941 case. But I noticed that Winston Churchill once said that to cast a man into prison without formulating any charge known to the law is in the highest degree odious and forms the basis of all totalitarian regimes, which I thought he was referring really to Nazi rule when he made those observations. But I thought it was a good point to reflect on, given what's happened in this case, rather than people just jumping up and down, talking about the morals or otherwise of the case. It's quite interesting, isn't it, that we have fallen a little from that. And there must be a division in powers between the state and the judiciary.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the prison analogy is quite a good one, because in a writ of habeas corpus, you'd have to understand whether or not someone was in fact detained and to what extent the nation state is keeping those people overseas away from their nation. So there's a lot to do in terms of collecting evidence or knowing what the situation is. But certainly for those other than Miss Begum that don't have that high profile, about whom there might be less risk to national security, I think it would be an interesting test to issue a writ of habeas corpus and see whether or not that process, after so many thousands of years, could exist in a rather better way, perhaps, than the Joyce Lord Horhor example, and maybe following the tentative progress that's been made in Australia about deciding where people belong. And it would be lovely to know where you belong and not be wandering the earth stateless or assumed to be a dual national or labelled a foreign fighter without a process that decides whether you're a criminal or not in the absence of a declaration of war. So I think that sort of rhetoric from Churchill is often quite useful for the public to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about nation states taking responsibility. And of course, it's very, very complex, and ISIS is a fluid beast that is almost impossible to catch. So it does raise concerns in the minds of the general public about how safe would we be if we did this. And I think sometimes it just comes down to working out how you can do things safely rather than saying it's not safe to do so.
Yes. Well, that is brilliant. Just before you go, I must ask you this question, really, which is about, well, she didn't have dual nationality, but she was second generation Pakistani. I've lost my place in the judgment now. But she did have another nationality in theory, which when this is reported in sort of, you know, radio, mainstream media, reference is made to. It's here I'm concerned about the law. But what impact, if any, does having grandparents being from, I want to say Pakistan, I'm just trying to find the part in the judgment, have on anything? You know, could she, if people who were...
I get what you're saying. I understand the point and I get what you're concerned about, which is what of people who have dual nationality or they inherit some form of nationality from their grandparents?
Yeah.
What we currently have is an executive decision that she belongs somewhere else. And that's a political decision that she belongs somewhere else on legislation that's been created by Parliament. And you have to remember that Parliament voted for this stuff, and so it carries some weight. And yeah, the decision is made by the Secretary of State against that background and some evidence that's provided to him that she belongs somewhere else because of her line of heritage. And the real issue that the law that we looked at considers is what you've really got to think about is what are the criteria that make you a subject of somewhere. Now, what some might say, well, if you're born here, that's much stronger than if you've got a grandma that was born in Bangladesh or wherever else it is.
Yes.
But actually, your allegiance is to the place that you were born. Now, the Australian cases say, well, being born here is not enough. What other criteria? And they're very carefully trying to sift out what the criteria are. You know, what is your connection? We would say, well, where's my family?
Yes.
And you might have people, I don't know, that are in the RAF and they travel all over the world, but they belong to the United Kingdom. And that's a no-brainer. We know where they are, but where they belong. So I think the way the courts are moving carefully, ironically, over thousands of years, without actually saying what is the final criteria, we need to look at this particular person. So I think the legislation allows the executive to say, well, we think you belong elsewhere, so we're going to exercise our powers under statute. But the law that we researched and provided to the court said, well, hang on a minute, there's more to it than that. It's what makes them a subject, not just a citizen. Where do they actually belong? And you've really got to decide that before you take their citizenship, which is an administrative process away that would actually make it more hard for them to travel in and out, of course, because they can't waive a passport. But there's something more to it, you know. Had a bit of a joke. People have labelled me because recently, of course, I've been dealing with cases involving hundreds of years of law, and yes, now I've done thousands of years of law. So I've been labelled the Queen of Ancient Remedies. And whether it is a remedy or not, I can't say. I can only say here's a load of law that I think everybody should be thinking about, including the UK Supreme Court, the Australian High Court, maybe issuing a writ in the Australian Federal Court for those Australian citizens currently stranded in Syrian camps, and really challenging in a world where we're thinking more and more about the nation state again, having thought about globalization post Second World War, really challenging what does it mean? Who is the population that belongs? Who are the subjects of which nation state? And that can help with all sorts of administrative arrangements and could be quite helpful to government. So I think maybe the old law is sometimes the solution, and we try to look for modern solutions when it's been sitting there staring us in the face if we'd only opened a very dusty book.
Yes. Well, it's really interesting. I can't wait to talk about some of the other cases you've been involved in. You know, I'm a sucker for law, and I follow your work closely, not just in the International Criminal Courts and, of course, the Special Courts of Kosovo, but also here in our own country in the UK, JOGI, which changed the law on joint enterprise. So I look forward to discussing that more because I think that law and guidance is really important and for the public to understand, perhaps in a much more plain and basic level, rather than just becoming incredibly emotive about subjects.
Well, I'll do my best. I try and think of it a bit like horrible histories. You know, it's horrible law. We tell you about some old law and make it fun. So I'll see what I can do next time.
Brilliant. Well, Felicity Gerry, thank you so much for joining me on this Talking Law and Guidance podcast. I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.